wait to see what the issues are that may divide us, but the starting point is pretty good.
Cautious optimism for working together from the new state House and Senate leaders. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, November 21st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the woman who filed a complaint against the Blood Bank of Alaska disputes the board's claims.
It's misleading to the point of being a lie to say that they only store a small amount of blood in that blood bank.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Both houses of the legislature will have new leaders in January. Incoming Senate President Pete Kelly and House Speaker Bryce Edgman both say they have positive feelings toward the other. But they lead very different caucuses that will likely have different priorities in the coming legislative session. APRN's Andrew Kitchenman spoke with both as they prepare for their new positions.
Bryce Edgman is becoming the Speaker of the House because of a new mostly Democratic coalition that also includes Republicans and Independents. The Dillingham Democrat says he expects a difficult year ahead.
We're essentially down to 1 year's worth of savings, and a lot of the easy choices are not there anymore. And I think it's going to be incumbent upon the legislature to take decisive action on not only the current fiscal challenges, but also the longer-term picture.
Pete Kelly is becoming president of a Senate whose Republican-led majority is pretty similar to last session. The Fairbanks Republican also wants to make progress in closing the state's more than $3 billion budget gap, but he says there's actually a danger in entirely closing the gap. He says that will feed the demand for government to grow.
Deficit like that and say, we have to do everything we can to fill that deficit right now. The problem with that is that if you fill it, particularly with taxes, the next year government will have a tendency to grow, and then you're going to want more taxes, and you're going to be back in the same position over a period of time.
Edgman and Kelly first met in the 1990s, when Kelly served in the House, and Edgman was a legislative aide. The relationship between the two could be important in smoothing over the differences between the chambers. The House majority is united around building a comprehensive plan to solve the state's fiscal crisis that will likely support a broad-based tax, like an income or sales tax, along with spending cuts and use of permanent fund earnings for the budget. The Senate declined to consider a broad-based tax last year, but it did advance a bill to spend from permanent fund earnings that was rejected by the House. Edgman is hopeful about working with Kelly.
I'm confident that I'll have a good relationship with the incoming president. And in terms of working together, House and Senate, I think he's going to strive to do his best job, and certainly will I.
Kelly says he has a positive view of Edgman.
I like Bryce, and I don't know what is going to be their main objectives, so we'll wait to see what the issues are that may divide us. But the starting point is pretty good. Bryce is a pretty good guy in my book, and I enjoy dealing with him.
Both Edgman and Kelly moved to their leadership roles from positions on their chamber's finance committees. Both say they'll miss the committee post. They have another thing in common these days. They both are sounding a note of caution. Neither wants to say something now that their caucus will later disagree with. Edgman declined to comment when he was asked about Kelly's reluctance to entirely close the deficit.
I don't want to get ahead of the caucus and provide any commentary that hasn't been the subject of caucus deliberation.
And Kelly says it's too soon to say what major legislation will advance in the Senate.
There's this period of time between the election and when we actually get seated that we tried to formulate a path forward, and that hasn't been done yet.
There is one area Kelly and Edgman are seeing differences. Kelly already says that there may be a bit of a battle between Governor Bill Walker and the Senate over further increasing oil and gas taxes. Edgman says it's possible that the House will work with Walker, and he hopes the Senate, on oil and gas taxes. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Last Friday, we brought you a story about the Blood Bank of Alaska holding a press conference to dispute allegations that were part of a complaint filed with the Food and Drug Administration by a former employee. That employee, Linda Soriano, claimed that over the summer, BBA's blood supply had gotten dangerously low because of financial incentives to over-export blood in order to pay for the new, larger building that opened earlier this year. Soriano did not return repeated requests for comment last week, but has since spoken out about the blood bank's claims. Soriano is one of six employees who contributed to the original complaint, and it's her name signed at the bottom. She disagrees with BBA's claims about blood supply.
It's misleading to the point of being a lie to say that they only store a small amount of blood in that blood bank.
Soriano says the audited materials used in BBA's internal review only capture a small sliver of the organization's overall operations and management. On top of that, she says, the report uses audit materials from before BBA shifted operations to its new location, which is when the financial pressure to meet a larger debt burden and rising costs actually began.
All of the financial problems, all of the inventory problems that I referred to in the FDA complaint began when we moved into the new building in February.
Soriano says employees were misled about financial details in the blood bank's budgeting and alleges the board's perspective on the complicated business of blood banking is out of step with what employees see on the ground. Sunday was the International Transgender Day of Remembrance. More than 80 people gathered in Anchorage to honor those who lost their lives because of transphobia. Those in attendance also discussed ways to prevent violence in the future. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman was there.
Standing in a wide circle around the edges of the sanctuary at St. Mary's Episcopal Church, community members held candles and read the names of some of the transgender individuals from around the world who were killed this past year.
H.M. Prieto Medina.
T.T. Safor.
295 brightly colored paper stars were taped to the walls around them, representing each of the known victims. The Trans Murder Monitoring Project, which tracks the data, says the number is far from complete because it only includes cases where the victims are identified as trans in the reports of their deaths. The organization says most countries don't track murders of trans people, and in some places, trans identities are not openly acknowledged. Christina Eubanks-Ohana came up with the idea of covering the walls with stars and purposefully chose bright colors to honor how families will remember those who were lost.
To have them lost in such a tragic way, and yet there always will be to you. You'll remember them always as those toddlers and those, you know, rambunctious children. And I really liked that this was a really vibrant way of remembering them.
Event organizer Jessica Green says the Day of Remembrance is about more than just acknowledging the victims. It's also a call to action for the wider community to recognize and support trans people.
It's about using that privilege, whether it's white privilege, male privilege, cisgender privilege. It's using that privilege that we just get because we're some way to really advocate for those who maybe don't get that privilege.
Antoinette Harper, who spoke during the ceremony, says the best way to fight violence against the transgender community is to increase awareness, because violence stems from fear of the unknown.
So for the rest of the trans world, my suggestion is, don't start hiding now, and silence is no longer golden.
She says people need to know one basic thing.
That we are human. We are not some alien beings, that are out to molest and abduct your children or steal your husbands. No, we are human beings. We live just like everyone else. We have jobs. We pay taxes. We vote.
From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Great Alaska Shootout hits the courts this week.
I think all around we have five or six teams playing in the tournament this year that won 20 games or more last year.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
Ketchikan's Vigor Industrial rolled out the forward half of the Alaska-class ferry Taslina on Sunday. With that 800-ton portion out of the assembly hall, shipyard employees can get started now on the back half. KRBD's Layla Carey has more.
It takes coordination and planning to move 800 tons of half-built ferry, even when it's moving just a couple hundred feet. On a frosty, windy, blue sky southeast Alaska morning, a handful of Ketchikan shipyard employees kept a close eye on the huge chunk of welded steel as it inched out of its tight quarters in the assembly hall and into the light of day. The ferry isn't done, not by a long shot, but this is an important moment for the shipyard, which received the $100 million state contract to build two Alaska-class ferries in fall of 2014. Here's Doug Ward, Director of Shipyard Development, summarizing what just happened while we warmed up with hot coffee indoors.
Today, the Marine Division rolled out the forward half of the state ferry Taslina into its berth one position. The very next thing that will happen inside the building is the engine room modules will be we've been working on for the last several months. Those will go into the assembly hall, and we'll start building units and stacking modules for the aft half of the Taslina.
The forward half was made watertight with fitted plywood to keep out Ketchikan's typical wet weather, and finishing work will continue inside that section while the aft half is assembled. Dockmaster Greg Howe says once the back end is complete, they'll roll it out and weld the two together.
The second half of the ship will actually go quite a bit quicker because a considerable part of the aft of the ship is already constructed. It's sitting in modules and other parts of the yard and will be assembled in the assembly hall here over the next 8 months. And we should be rolling the aft half out early summer, midsummer.
The Taslina is the first Alaska-class ferry, and because of that is taking the longest. With this first ship, Vigor employees had to work on detailed designs, fabricate tools and templates, and work out any kinks in the plans. The second ferry, the Hubbard, should go faster. Other than the name, Ward says the ships will be pretty much identical.
So when we start on two, on the Hubbard, we'll have that learning curve.
Howe added that the shipyard's young workforce has been in training, and by the time they start on the Hubbard, those workers will have more experience to work faster. Alan Coffin is the project manager and was all smiles as the forward half of the ferry rolled out of the hall. Back in the office, he says it was exhilarating, and it'll be even better when they roll out the other end.
But this is a huge accomplishment. I mean, you see how big that thing is coming out of the shop. You know, 150-ton cranes and they're 100 feet in the air, and we're just clearing those with the ship. So it's a huge accomplishment. I mean, sit back and look at, we're doing that little old Ketchikan here. It's crazy. It's really crazy.
The Alaska-class ferries contract calls for final delivery by late 2018. The Taslina should be in the water for sea trials by fall of next year. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
The GCI Great Alaska Shootout Basketball Tournament tips off this week in Anchorage. This is the tournament's 39th year, but as Alaska Public Media's Josh Edge reports, a 40th is not guaranteed as the university grapples with a shrinking budget.
The University of Alaska Anchorage's women's basketball team will open up its tournament Tuesday against Portland. The Seawolves are coming off a second-place finish at last season's Division II National Championships, and UAA Athletic Director Keith Hackett says even with several new players, the team's expectations are high.
I think what the secret is going to be now is getting them all to mesh and play together like the team last year was so close. But I think this team is equally as close right now.
Teams from Missouri State University and Southern California round out the women's field. The UAA men's basketball team will face the University of Buffalo on Wednesday in the first round. Overall, Hackett says this year's field is the best he's seen during his tenure.
I think all around we have five or six teams playing in the tournament this year that won 20 games or more last year.
Drake University, Iona College, University of Nevada, Las Vegas, Oakland University, UC Davis, and Weber State are also competing for the men's shootout title. Hackett says ESPN's decision following the 2007 tournament to part ways with the Great Alaska Shootout has made recruiting teams difficult, despite the shootout's current national television contract with the CBS Sports Network.
There's a lot of people that watch it, but it's difficult to get some teams to think about coming to Anchorage just because it's so far north. And they have so many other options.
This year, Hackett says there are 42 preseason tournaments teams can choose from. Another limiting factor in convincing teams to travel to Alaska, Hackett says, is how much the tournament pays.
We have to pay a guarantee to get teams here, and they range from $40,000 to $70,000, depending on distance and quality. So, yeah, we have to pay. But by comparison, other tournaments are paying $150,000 or $200,000 to teams to come.
Those numbers are specific to the men's teams. Hackett says the guarantee for the women's side of the tournament typically ranges from $15,000 to $20,000 per team.
Depends on who's here. If we got a team like Connecticut and, you know, if we had them come, we'd have to probably pay them a little bit more. But by paying them more, we're going to draw more people to see Connecticut or Florida State, someone like that. So, but it's the women's teams have been a little bit less because, to be honest, the women's teams haven't demanded that higher amount. So, who knows? The future, they may.
But whether it's $15,000 or $70,000, that guarantee needs to at least cover a team's travel expenses, including airfare, hotels, and meals. Hackett expects the shootout to bring in around $450,000 in revenue this year, with the rest of the money for the tournament's more than $750,000 tab coming out of the athletic department's budget. Even though the tournament does not break even from ticket sales and sponsorships, Hackett says the economic impact stretches beyond the university.
There are probably 150 to 200 rooms being rented during Thanksgiving week, due in large measure because of the shootout. All those people are eating in restaurants.
The tournament is entering its 39th year and has evolved into a cornerstone of Alaska's sports scene. But with declining state funding and budgetary belt tightening across the university, Hackett says a 40th is not a guarantee.
Our economy in Alaska is hitting everybody. So we're going to do everything we can to keep this around, and everything is on the table still.
The future of the shootout should become more clear during the upcoming legislative session as lawmakers finalize the state budget. But for this year, the tournament is a go. The women's tournament tips off Tuesday, and the men's opens Wednesday. For more information about the 2016 GCI Great Alaska Shootout, visit GoSeaWolves.com. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Matt Nuska, Susitna Borough's annual Salmon Symposium brings together researchers and conservationists for updates on how to better manage and protect salmon habitat. The event got underway last Thursday in Palmer. Howard Delo is vice chair of the borough's Fish and Wildlife Commission, which is organizing a salmon research plan for the borough. Delo says there are many reasons to protect the valley's salmon runs. One is economic, because healthy fish runs add to the area's economy.
That's the tourism effect. The bed and breakfast, the gas stations, the grocery stores, the restaurants, the fishing tackle shops, the guides, they're all being impacted because it's like coffee. If you can't get your coffee here, you're going to go somewhere else. If you can't get your fish in Matsu, you're going to go somewhere else. And that has a decided economic impact.
core king salmon and silver salmon returns in recent years have worried state and borough officials. In fact, DLO says the measurement of sport fishing activity in the borough has decreased by about half since 2008. DLO says informational meetings like the Salmon Symposium can help bridge the divide between sport and commercial fishing interests. The symposium does not take a political stance for or against any of the salmon fishery user groups. Setting fishery allocations is the job of the State Board of Fisheries, which has to balance the health of the salmon resource with the demands of the various user groups for a share of the resource.
But where they actually can help groups like the commission, when we're going to the Board of Fish, but if they've got some science that says, look, we need to do this for the health of the resource, they're not advocating, they're just making a flat scientific fact. And that's how the board should be moving ahead, is protecting the resource first. Then you can go fight over who gets how much of it.
The borough in recent years has had to advocate for more help for area salmon stocks that are in decline. Of the 13 salmon stocks of concern designated by the Board of Fish, half are in valley streams. A stock of concern is one that fails to maintain specific yields or harvestable surpluses despite management measures. DLO points out that Susitna, Yentna, Sockeye have been on the stock of concern list for about 8 years. Advocates of more oil development in Alaska's Arctic believe they have a champion in Donald Trump. But the president-elect has not mentioned the Arctic in his few public speeches since Election Day. He did not respond by Twitter or otherwise to last week's announcement that the Interior Department has removed the Arctic from its 5-year offshore leasing plan. Today, Trump released a video with a Made in America message, likely to please advocates of domestic oil production.
My agenda will be based on a simple core principle, putting America first. Whether it's producing steel, building cars, or curing disease, I want the next generation of production and innovation to happen right here on our great homeland, America.
He listed a few priorities and then got to energy, though Trump did not name the Arctic among his examples.
I will cancel job-killing restrictions on the production of American energy, including shale energy and clean coal, creating many millions of high-paying jobs.
Trump has yet to reveal his pick for Interior Secretary, a position with enormous influence over Alaska. Among the potential nominees who met with Trump this weekend was Congresswoman Kathy McMorris Rogers. The Republican from Washington State is said to be in the running for Interior Secretary. Reuters reports that former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin is on the shortlist, too.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. It's a fact, 85% of Alaska Native and American Indian people don't use illegal drugs. For more resources on building a healthy life, visit anthc.org/weare. This message sponsored by ANTHC, a nonprofit organization.
Two Homer Electric Association members filed a formal complaint with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska last week regarding HEA's ongoing deregulation election. Peter McKay of Kenai and Homer resident Bob Shavelson allege HEA did not openly disclose plans to deregulate its subsidiary organization, Alaska Electric and Energy Cooperative, or AEEC. The subsidiary has the same nine-member board of directors as HEA. It also has the same general manager, Brad Janorski. According to the deregulation election process detailed in the RCA docket, the HEA board will take a vote on whether to deregulate the subsidiary. Shavelson, who is also the executive director of Cook Inlet Keeper, says HEA has not been forthcoming about its plans to deregulate the subsidiary.
During the summer, there were press accounts where the general manager said that they would not try to deregulate the subsidiary, which is where most of the assets and most of the debt resides. And then, lo and behold, a couple weeks ago, they go and file for that deregulation. So we haven't been given accurate information. And again, that that implicates the issue of trust, and that's why we feel that they shouldn't be an unregulated monopoly and there should be some basic oversight from the Regulatory Commission of Alaska.
David Thomas is an HEA board member. He says the board will only vote to deregulate if HEA members approve deregulation. The board filed the paperwork to deregulate the subsidiary in case members vote to approve local control, Thomas says.
The intent of the HEA board is to vote as the members voted. So if a majority of the HEA members vote for local control, then we would vote that AENEC be locally controlled. And so we've started that paperwork, so we have that option.
HEA General Manager Jen Orski was not available for comment. RCA Chairman Bob Pickett also declined to comment, but says the RCA is actively considering the issue. Ballots were mailed to HEA members in October and must be returned within 30 days. At least 15% of HEA's roughly 23,000 members must vote in the election for the results to be valid. The results of the HEA deregulation vote will be announced by December 30th. Juneau's animal control officials want mandatory microchipping of pets they deem potentially dangerous or dangerous. The Juneau Assembly is considering an ordinance with the requirement at the committee level tonight. KTO's Jeremy Shea stopped by Gastineau Humane Society to find out more.
And scan.
Put it on the dog's neck. And at night, it's just
9823.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's Sushi.
Sushi is a super cute black and white kitten that Rachel Trapp is holding in one hand. 9823 are the last four digits of a long identification number that shows up on the microchip scanner Trapp's holding in her other hand. The number comes from a rice grain-sized microchip under Sushi's skin. The chips aren't tracking devices, but when scanned, they positively identify a specific animal, which is helpful when lost pets are found, or when problematic ones are wrangled. Sushi probably doesn't fit the legal definition of a dangerous animal, for which chips would be required under a proposed Juneau ordinance, but the Humane Society chips animals in its care as a matter of course and encourages pet owners to do it voluntarily. At Gastineau Humane Society, it costs $40. Veterinarians also offer microchipping service. Gastineau Humane Society handles the city's animal control services under contract. In a memo to Assembly members, Executive Director Matt Musselwhite says the microchipping requirement and other proposed changes to pet codes are in response to, quote, an incident involving a dangerous dog or compliance issues with the animal's owner, end quote. Violators would be subject to fines and citations issued by animal control officers. According to Musselwhite, many other states have similar microchipping requirements for dangerous dogs. In California, New York, and several Western European countries, microchips are required for all dogs. In Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
Finally tonight, we have a correction. In a story last week, we misstated the number of leases Arctic Slope Regional Corporation acquired in the Beaufort Sea. It is 21, not 2. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Jeremy Shea in Juneau, Zachariah Hughes, Ann Hillman and Josh Edge in Anchorage, Layla Carey in Ketchikan, Ellen Lockyer in Palmer, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., and Shayla Farzan in Homer. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Our editor and producer is Sean Dugan. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. And by
GCI. Keeping Alaskans connected to live the life they choose. GCI is an Alaska-born and raised telecommunications company and a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media.
The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 directory for older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.